From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we discuss some of the problems facing Africa. Washington Post reporter Blaine Harden is the author of a new book on sub-Saharan Africa. Also today, a talk with the head writer of Late Night with David Letterman. Steve O'Donnell created the ever-popular Top 10 lists. Book critic John Leonard reviews John Updike's final Rabbit novel. And on the 50th anniversary of John Lennon's birth, rock historian Ed Ward plays some of the records that Lennon listened to when he was starting to perform. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. In a virtually unprecedented move, the United States is proposing a United Nations resolution condemning the Israeli actions yesterday that led to the killing of at least 21 Palestinians. NPR's Anne Garrels reports.
U.S. officials say the resolution condemns Israel's excessive use of force, and it welcomes a fact-finding mission by the U.N. Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar. The U.S. hopes this resolution will meet Arab concerns, stop the spread of violence, and avoid a break in the coalition opposing Iraq. The five permanent members of the U.N. Security Council met privately this afternoon to come up with a common strategy acceptable to all. One sticking point is who should run the U.N. investigation. Many Europeans and Arabs want the Security Council to do it. Because this would include many of Israel's long-standing enemies, the U.S. insists on the more neutral Secretary General. Israel has already said it would not accept a Security Council delegation. A vote is expected later tonight. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
Palestinians buried their dead today after the worst violence in Jerusalem's old city since 1967. The city remains tense but quiet tonight. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Israeli police had braced for massive demonstrations and outbreaks of violence after yesterday's disturbances, in which at least 21 Palestinians were killed by border police. But a massive police presence combined with curfews and closures kept the violence to sporadic outbreaks. Israeli authorities took the extraordinary step of closing the Temple Mount and the Dome of the Rock Mosque to visits and prayers. Some Muslims protested that Israel has no right to close a Muslim holy place and tried to enter. Police fired tear gas, and the Mufti, the senior Muslim religious figure, was temporarily hospitalized from the tear gas. Two Israeli border policemen were also stabbed by Arabs in a village in southern Jerusalem. There were violent demonstrations in Arab villages in Israel's north, and 25 Arabs were arrested. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
The State Department says that about 400 Americans and their foreign-born family members have signed up for tomorrow's evacuation flight from Iraq. Most of the evacuees are now in Kuwait. They'll be transported to the Iraqi city of Basra, where a U.S. government-chartered plane will pick them up. The flight will take them to North Carolina's Raleigh-Durham Airport after a stop in London. The evacuation will be limited to women and children and American men of Arab ancestry. According to the most recent State Department estimates, there are now more than 900 Americans still stranded in Kuwait and more than 300 in Iraq. Stock prices plunged today on Wall Street, responding to uneasiness about the Persian Gulf, with the worst decline since early August. The Dow Jones Industrials lost 78 points to close at 2,445.54. Declines led advances by a margin of 7-1 in moderate trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Blaine Harden was the Washington Post bureau chief in sub-Saharan Africa from 1985 to 1989. He arrived at the height of the Ethiopian famine. One of the first people he interviewed was an Ethiopian woman whose child had just died of starvation. As they spoke, he noticed her fingertips were falling off, a condition of leprosy. Harden would encounter many other scenes of suffering during his 4 years in Africa, and he learned of the dire condition of the continent. The population growth is high and food production low. Central and East Africa are plagued with AIDS. The rainforests and the animal population are being destroyed. Civil wars have created the world's largest refugee problem. But Harden doesn't believe the continent is doomed. Blaine Harden has written a book about sub-Saharan Africa called Africa: Dispatches from a Fragile Continent. He writes that after coming to know the continent, he found himself more and more intolerant of a soft-focused stereotype of Africa.
Well, it's the stereotype that Africa should be viewed through the lenses of colonialism, that it should be a place where people can buy some Banana Republic clothes and go and look at game and think that this is what Africa should be, is now and should be forever. I think Nigeria is more typical of what Africa is and will be becoming. The game, unfortunately, will probably have to go the way of the American buffalo, because there are lots of people in Africa. The population is growing faster than any population has ever grown in the history of the world. There are 600 million plus now. That will double in 20 years. And those who look at Africa and try to understand it are going to have to realize that Africa is going to be a place where the problems are political and about people and not about miles and miles of bloody Africa and Maasai warriors in the tall grass.
But Maasai warriors are people, and the issues that affect them are partly political.
Well, it's true, but it's the idea that the continent should conform to stereotypes rather than become what it is becoming, which is a slowly modernizing region of the world.
Let's talk about some of the political problems facing African countries now. You describe some of the sub-Saharan countries as having a kleptocratic state. Is this a new word?
It's a word that's been coined by political scientists who've been studying Africa for the past 30 years. What it means is that African leaders, by and large, in the 45 countries of sub-Saharan Africa, have very little political legitimacy other than the legitimacy they can buy or coerce. They, by and large, are not elected. They do not serve terms that are limited by law. There's no two-term rule in any country. In fact, there's never been an African leader who's been voted out by his constituents. They buy loyalty by trying to rig deals that give them a certain percentage of all the businesses in their country, and then they use that to buy loyalty from members of their own family, first of all, then their tribe, and then from allies. The most creative of these big men is probably Mobutu in Zaire, and he has managed to create the kleptocratic state in which everyone expects the system to work based on graft. For example, a new minister, say in transportation, will not look to building roads or building bridges. He will look to getting contracts for roads or bridges that give him the highest kickback potential in the least amount of time, because he knows that the bridge or the road is likely not to be constructed, and he also knows that he's not likely to hold his job for very long. So the idea is to get what you can as quickly as possible. And this is what government amounts to in Zaire.
Well, you were exposed to corruption just traveling around. What are some examples of the types of corruption you had to put up with?
Well, I guess the best example is when I was planning to take a boat trip on the Zaire River from the interior out to the capital. And my cholera vaccination had expired, and I went to the official in Kisangani who was in charge of looking at cholera, and he looked at me and shook his head, and then after a while he said, perhaps we have a solution. And he pulled out of his drawer a rubber stamp, which was my vaccination against cholera, and I just had to give him some money. It wasn't a whole lot by American standards. It was $4 or $5, I think.
Did he give you a vaccination or just a rubber stamp?
No, he stamped my passport in such a way that I was vaccinated against cholera.
Were you worried that you'd get cholera, or is the whole need for the vaccination in the first place just to have another reason to pay people off?
Well, yes, that's true. Cholera vaccinations don't work, by and large, and most countries in Africa do not require them anymore. And it's just sort of an elaborate farce, which is only played in Zaire. It was the only time that ever happened, actually.
My guest is reporter Blaine Harden, and he was the bureau chief for the Washington Post in sub-Saharan Africa from 1985 to 1989, and he's just written a book called Africa, Dispatches from a Fragile Continent. Tell us what you think the typical traits are of the big man, the kind of leader who you think has become typical in sub-Saharan Africa.
Almost all of the 45 leaders, in the 45 countries of sub-Saharan Africa, the leaders carry similar traits. They aren't elected, first of all, and if they were to submit to elections, they would be likely to lose. They go to church. Every pronouncement is on the front page of the papers in the countries that they control. As in Kenya, the first words that one hears when watching the evening news is, "Today, His Excellency the President Daniel Arap Moi said." This happens day after day, year after year. The leaders pretend to believe in whatever philosophy the donors who have the most money are espousing. For example, in Zaire, Mobutu will say that he's a free marketeer in order to get money from the World Bank and the IMF and the United States government. In other countries, such as Ethiopia, Mengistu Haile Mariam will profess to be a communist or a Marxist in order to get arms to fight against his rebels in the north. It's a rather cynical manipulation, and the whole idea is to hold on to power.
You also say that the big man is usually the richest man in the country with his picture on all the money.
Picture on the money, and it's important that he is the richest man, but it's even more important that he is known to be the richest man, because wealth in sub-Saharan Africa, in the absence of law, in the absence of courts, in the absence of legislatures, is power per se. Any money that is not controlled by the big man is dissidence.
Can we look at Samuel Doe, the late Samuel Doe of Liberia, who was just killed off? Where does he fit in your picture of the big man?
Well, he's the...
Did he fit in? Yeah.
Yeah, he was the top of the pile of the bad guys. And what's particularly interesting about Liberia is that Liberia is, by and large, an American colony. It was founded by freed American slaves. It's the only country in Africa where the people speak with an inflection that somehow sounds American. They admire America there. They follow it very closely. Their political system is designed to be an imitation. Samuel Kenyon Doe came to power in 1980 by leading a band of soldiers, and they went upstairs and eviscerated the sitting president at the time, while Samuel Kenyon Doe actually didn't go inside. He hid in the bushes. But he later took over control of the country. He began a 10-year process of destroying the country. But what's interesting to note is that during the first 5 years, he sweet-talked the U.S. government into believing that he would turn over power after a free and fair election. He promised this to the ambassador. He watched tapes of President Ronald Reagan speaking so that he could learn to speak a more presentable brand of English. And he promised that he would step down. I was there for the election in 1985. And the first time that Liberians ever had a chance to vote in such a free way. And they came out and voted in high numbers, and they voted against Samuel Kenyon Doe. In the counting of the election, ballots were simply burned on the edge of town, and Doe made up the count. There were American diplomats who observed it, who wrote to Washington and said this was an elaborate farce, we should not support him. But the Reagan administration at the time did not follow the advice of the State Department people who were there on hand, as well as the journalists who were there, calling it a sort of sick joke. And so Doe was confirmed as president. A few months later, there was an attempted coup. Doe and Doe's soldiers, the members of his Kron tribe, began a series of tribal retaliations against those who were involved in the coup. And Liberia suddenly had a problem that it did not have before, which was tribal hatred and a desire for revenge. What's happened in the past 10 months in Liberia is sort of the bitter fruit of the past 10 years. And I think it's fair to say that the United States government is to blame in part. If it would have insisted that Doe step down after this election was stolen, as it insisted that Marco step down, about the same time, Doe probably would have not had a chance to survive. The U.S. at the time was giving Liberia more money per capita than to any country in sub-Saharan Africa, and more than just about any country in the world. And they were buying a monster.
When you reported on the Liberian election in 1985, did you report that Samuel Doe had stolen the election? Did you put it that bluntly?
Yes, I was very blunt. But it did not seem to affect the judgment of the people in Washington. There was really no doubt about what happened. But as has happened many times in Africa, the people in Washington sometimes prefer to go with the bad guy they know than the bad guy that they don't know. I was told by ambassadors there in as late as 89 that Doe promised a democratic exercise, and that's what he gave us, and so we must stick with him.
What do you see ahead for the future of Liberia?
It's a very dark future, I think. There is, in effect, no government right now. There's a West African peacekeeping force in there that is beginning to fight against Charles Johnson, the rebel leader. It could turn into a protracted civil war. The country's infrastructure has been largely destroyed by the fighting. More than 500,000 people are dislocated, outside of the country now. It's a tragic situation that need not have happened if the statecraft of the United States had been a little more moral, a little sharper. In fact, I think the lesson from Liberia that the U.S. government learned was to, if they're going to supervise an election, they have to withdraw support for the person who loses afterwards. And I think this lesson was learned with Marcos and with Noriega, in fact.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about Africa. My guest is Blaine Harden, and he was the bureau chief for the Washington Post in sub-Saharan Africa from 1985 to 89. And he's written a new book called Africa, Dispatches from a Fragile Continent. This is Fresh Air. Talking with Blaine Harden about Africa, where he reported from the Washington Post for 1985 to 89. Why do you think the countries of sub-Saharan Africa have such a poor record of leadership?
I think it's because of the fundamentally fictional nature of the nations. The colonial juggernaut that came into Black Africa in the 1880s and 1890s came in with an incredible sense of its own superiority. It imposed artificial boundaries on Africa, sort of an artificial overlay was pressed onto the continent. And the way the states worked were there was top-down management, and they were designed to extract mineral wealth and agricultural wealth and to keep people quiet. In late 1950s, early 1960s, the colonialists packed up and left for a variety of reasons. But what they left were these artificial states which had a legacy of being run from the top down. A new elite, a black elite, came in and took over the states and ran them in basically the same way. They didn't run them as efficiently, but they used the same top-down methods. And the only means that were left to the new elite to control their nations, to keep them together, were coercion and bribery. If they would have gone along with the constitutions that were written at the time, which would have allowed free elections, which would have allowed freedom of choice, the countries probably would have dissolved because the people did not believe in them. So people wrote constitutions that guaranteed free elections, that guaranteed courts, that guaranteed education, and they ignored them. And they went to work buying loyalty or coercing it.
You've described tribalism as the fundamental political illness of modern Africa. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, I think it's the fundamental political reality of Africa. And what Black Africa governments, citizens need to do is they need to switch their allegiance from their tribe to their nation, from their family to themselves and to a more westernized standard of success. That is the way that other developing countries have moved up in terms of per capita income and the other indices of progress in the past 20 years. However, there's one important thing to say about tribalism and the family, extended family, is that in the absence of government, which is pretty much the state of affairs all across Black Africa, the tribe and the family are essentials in as a sort of homegrown social welfare network. I talked to a professor of an economics professor at the University of Nairobi. He had a corn crop coming in around Lake Victoria. He couldn't go, but he knew that members of his family and member of his Luo tribe would get in that corn crop for him, and because his pay was low at the university, he needed it to eat and sell to other people. And that is the kind of system that works now in lieu of government. If government starts to build institutions like legislatures, like courts, like agricultural extension services that really work and serve people, then these older governing entities, such as tribes and families, will diminish in importance as they have in the rest of the developing world.
Are you projecting cultural Western cultural values onto Africa when you suggest that they loosen tribal ties?
I guess in a certain way I am, but I'm doing that based on having spent a lot of time talking to a lot of Africans about what they see has to happen to the continent for it to fit into the modern world. And Africa really has no choice. It cannot be a place, as I said earlier, of where there are zebras running around everywhere, and people have to make a living, particularly when their population doubles every 20 years. They have to have governments and corporations and ways of producing wealth to handle all these people. The collapse of the evolution away from tribalism as the most important governing factor is part of what every educated African wants to see. They feel, I think, that it is absolutely necessary to have loyalties to law rather than to tribal values, because then you have a level playing field for business, for achievement in art, in everything. There are certain tribal quotas that must be met in almost every African country, regardless of actual capabilities. This holds Africa back. And I've been told by really thousands of Africans that the process is moving too slowly because governments do not work. Governments afflict rather than govern, so people have to fall back on what they know and what they know will work to a certain extent, which is their extended family and their tribe.
My guest is reporter Blaine Harden, and he was the bureau chief for the Washington Post in sub-Saharan Africa from 1985 to 89. He's written a new book called Africa, Dispatches from a Fragile Continent. Well, you've really painted such a grim picture. You know, you've criticized tribalism, you've criticized the government, you've criticized foreign aid. It seems like, well, where do you turn? You know, what do you look for a solution?
Well, I think what you look for a solution is what's happening in Nigeria. Nigeria is the hopeful part of my book, and it's the most important country, I think, to understand in Africa because it's the biggest and it's the richest. Nigeria ropes together the Yoruba, the Hausa Fulani, and the Igbo. They were traditional strangers and enemies to each other for centuries. They did not get along well in Nigeria. They still do not get along that well. And they had a terrible war in which more than 1 million people lost their lives in the late 60s. And what that war did is it taught the Nigerians that war is no solution. It causes too much suffering. It was a cathartic experience. And after the war, Nigeria was lucky enough to benefit from $100 billion in oil profits. That was squandered, unfortunately. But in the process, they learned that government cannot control the wealth of a people because the government will waste it. And what's happening now in Nigeria is they're privatizing the major industries. Most significantly, they're privatizing the petroleum industry. There are hundreds of thousands of Nigerians who benefited from the oil boom to get technical educations in the United States and in other Western countries. Right now, the current leadership is a military dictatorship in a way, but it is moving systematically towards democratic elections in a couple years. The leader's name is Ibrahim Babangida, and he has promised free and fair elections, and if he does not deliver them, he will be overthrown. Most importantly, the Nigerians have an intolerance for dictators that I think is unique on the continent. They simply will not tolerate a man who denies them their basic rights. when generals in the past have promised elections and then delayed them, they were quickly overthrown. I think that Nigeria is building a civil society, which the rest of Africa doesn't have.
You, from 1985 to 89, were the bureau chief of the Washington Post in sub-Saharan Africa. And since then, you've been based in Eastern Europe. You're in Poland now. What's it like to go from one part of the world to another part of the world and be equally unfamiliar with both when you get there? I often wonder why reporters don't stay in one place longer. It seems pretty common for newspapers to move foreign correspondents from one country to another after a few years. Do you think that there are advantages in moving like that?
Well, there are some advantages. Let me talk about the disadvantages first. It's extremely difficult, and it's extremely disorienting. And I don't recommend it to any sane person to do it, particularly if you have to write about it with an expertise you may not have, which is what correspondents do for big newspapers. They simply have to learn while they run around. It's not pleasant. However, if you spend too long in any region of the world, I think you lose your awe at its difference compared to American culture. And what I try to do in writing about Africa or Eastern Europe is to give a sense of place, more important than anything else, that this is a different part of the world and this is what it looks and smells like. And unless that is in the stories, it's very hard to get readers other than policy analysts to look at your stories. Americans are distracted, they're busy, and for my money, the only way to get them to read, to learn, is to amaze and delight them with the difference with the different sights and sounds of different parts of the world.
Still, though, that lack of knowledge when a reporter gets to a place, do you ever look back at your early pieces and think, gee, I was really naive then?
Yes, particularly in Nigeria. Nigeria is for a Westerner going to Nigeria, it's really dirty and loud, smelly. And I wrote a piece about Lagos, which the Washington Post loved and put on the front page, which was, you know, young reporter goes to Lagos and is appalled and tries to make it funny. Over the next 4 years, I went there 5 more times, and I tried to understand the place. And it's still incredibly ugly and smelly, but there is an energy and a sense of progress in that country that is underneath all of those superficially miserable things. And that does take time to discover. And 4 or 5 years, luckily, is how long most of us stay in our posts. And by the end, we're writing good things.
Well, I want to thank you for talking with us about Africa. Thank you.
Thank you.
My guest has been Blaine Harden, and his new book about Africa is called Africa, Dispatches from a Fragile Continent. He's now based in Eastern Europe. He's the bureau chief there for the Washington Post. Next time on Fresh Air, Dennis Hopper. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we meet a man with an awesome responsibility. Steve O'Donnell is the head writer for Late Night with David Letterman, and he's in charge of coming up with each show's top 10 list. 50 years ago today, John Lennon was born. Coming up, Fresh Air rock historian Ed Ward tells us about some of the records that inspired Lennon's early sound. And John Leonard tells us what he thinks of John Updike's latest and final Rabbit novel, Rabbit at Rest. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush said today that he would go along with higher income taxes for wealthy Americans if it means a lower capital gains tax rate. But that message was contradicted later by a group of key Republican senators. NPR's Brian Naylor reports from the White House.
As the Bush administration and Congress attempted to pick up the pieces from last week's shattered budget agreement, there were some signs of confusion from the White House on the president's position on taxes. At a news conference this morning, President Bush indicated he'd go along with higher income taxes for some wealthy Americans in exchange for a cut in capital gains. But this evening, Republican senators emerged from a meeting with the president saying they would not vote for such a plan. What's more, according to Oregon's Bob Packwood, they have Mr. Bush's backing.
He very clearly said, I see the sentiment in this room, and I can clearly support that.
The president said he will do everything in his power to encourage Congress as it works in the next 10 days to fill in the details of the budget outline it approved yesterday. This is Brian Naylor at the White House.
There are reports this evening that Senate Finance Committee Chairman Senator Lloyd Bentsen will propose a new budget plan that would raise the top income tax rate by doing away with the so-called tax bubble and also cut capital gains taxes. Senate aides also say that the 2 cents a gallon tax on petroleum products is also done away with under this new plan. Concern over heightened tension in the Middle East has pushed up the price of oil on international markets. The price of North Sea crude moved over $40 again, $2 up on Monday's close. James Morgan of the BBC has more.
Oil analysts were quick to point to the nervousness of a market that politicians and officials are anxious to calm. On Monday, the International Energy Agency said stocks of oil were plentiful, and others have argued that the change in the market since the invasion of Kuwait can't justify the prices we've seen recently. Now they have doubled. But industry analysts say such arguments miss the point. The northern winter is setting in. There could be a cold snap of the kind that forced up prices initially in the United States last winter, even without any political problems. And on the question of stockpiles, they also argue that the reluctance of Western governments to make substantial withdrawals from stock has aggravated the situation. Only the Americans have announced any action on this front, and only a token amount has been withdrawn.
James Morgan of the BBC. According to the head of the Soviet Central Bank, Soviet currency will be devalued more than 3 times in some foreign trade starting the first of the year. Soviet officials say it's been decided that the new commercial exchange rate will be in the range of 2 rubles for one U.S. dollar. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down 78 points to close at 2,445.54 in only moderate trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. John Lennon would have been 50 years old today. The airwaves are filled with the sounds of Imagine and tributes remembering one version or another of Lennon's life and works. This occasion sent rock and roll historian Ed Ward back to Ray Coleman's 1984 biography of Lennon, and Ed's found some clues about the records John might have been listening to in the early days of the Beatles and before.
John Lennon's first group was the Quarrymen, and they were a skiffle band. Skiffle was a big fad in England in the late 50s, and the easiest way of explaining it is to say that it was American folk music played on a combination of acoustic guitars and homemade instruments, usually badly. Leadbelly's train song, Rock Island Line, was the cornerstone of any decent skiffle group's repertoire, and those of you with strong stomachs can seek out Lonnie Donegan's version of that. But the rock and roll influence was already there. We know that the Quarrymen also performed Mickey and Sylvia's classic, Love is Strange, although I bet none of them could play guitar as well as Mickey Baker could. When John met Paul McCartney, the chemistry between them was so strong that they started writing songs together almost immediately. But in Ray Coleman's Lennon biography, we also learn that at their first rehearsals, Paul brought in Little Richard's Rip It Up, and John contributed this Buddy Holly classic.
There you go, invited. Here am I, oh, will you? Left me here so I could sit and cry. Well, golly gee, what have you done to me? Oh, well, I guess it doesn't matter anymore.
As many of you know, Buddy Holly and the Crickets were very important to John. Beatles was a name coined in direct imitation of Crickets. Once the Beatles got going, the emphasis was on learning hit tunes that their audience would recognize, and so the early Beatles had plenty of Little Richard and Chuck Berry songs in their set list, numbers that are still familiar to most of today's rock and roll fans. But then as now, there were American rock and roll artists who were much more popular in Britain than in the U.S., people like Gene Vincent, Eddie Cochran, and this guy.
Anna.
Arthur Alexander's Anna was his only U.S. hit, but he was a big favorite in Britain, where lots of groups, not only the Beatles, covered his songs, including the Rolling Stones, who recorded You'd Better Move On. And although the Stones were more famous for doing such a thing, there's at least one instance where the Beatles took an obscure song and improved it. Since John was such a big girl group fan, revamping the B-side of the Shirelles hit Will You Love Me Tomorrow was probably his idea.
The important thing to remember is that these weren't oldies. They were hits of the day, and the Beatles were trying to stay contemporary. They didn't know they were changing the sound of pop music. They just understood when they heard something new, they should do it, like this.
Listening to the harmonica on Bruce Chanel's Hey Baby, John knew he had to try that himself, and the song led directly to his writing Love Me Do. The harmonica player, by the way, was a young lad from Fort Worth named Delbert McClinton. John Lennon remembered the songs of his youth for his entire life. Not only did he cut that album Rock and Roll in the post-Beatles days, but in one late Beatle classic, he snuck in a line from Chuck Berry's You Can't Catch Me.
New Jersey Turnpike in the wee-wee hours, I was rolling slow because of drizzling showers. Yeah, come a flat top, he was moving up with me. Then come waving goodbye in a little old souped-up jitney. I put my foot in my tank and I began to roll. Moaning siren towards the state patrol. So I let out my wings and then I blew my horn. Bye-bye, New Jersey, I become airborne. Now you can't catch me.
I know. I always thought that flat top line from Come Together sounded familiar. Who knows how John Lennon would have spent this birthday? Certainly I don't. But if he'd spent a part of the day reflecting on the half century behind him, maybe he'd have played some of these records.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll, and he writes for the Austin Chronicle.
Anna, you come and ask me, girl, to set you free, girl. say he loves you more than me, so I will set you free. Go with him. Go with him. Anna, girl, before you go now, I want you to know now that I still love you so. But if he loves you more, go with him.
This is Fresh Air. When David Letterman read his first top 10 list in 1985, nobody thought the idea would become an institution on the show. But since then, Letterman has read more than 500 of these lists. The idea of the top 10 list belongs to Steve O'Donnell. O'Donnell is head writer for the David Letterman show. There's a new book of late night's top 10 lists, and here's Steve O'Donnell to read one of them.
Top 10 things overheard on our first show. Number 10. I think he used to play Chip on My Three Sons. Number 9. It would be a shame if that bandleader ever lost his magnificent head of hair. Number 8. My name is Dave, and I'm here to sing, sing, sing. 7. Oh no, not Kmar the Magician. Number 6. You can't come in here, Mr. Snyder. Your show was canceled. Number 5. When is he going to take out those gag teeth? Number 4. Can you use the restroom upstairs? We're doing a show in here. Number 3, I can't believe Lord Melman would stoop to doing American television. Number 2, I sat through the show. Now where's my tote bag? And the number 1 thing overheard on our very first Letterman show. He's no Dinah.
Were you there for the very first Letterman show?
I joined the staff a couple of weeks in, but I did see the very first show. Bill Murray was a guest. It was a great show.
One of your ideas was the top 10 list. How did you come up with it?
Well, just barely an idea. I mean, it seemed like top 10 lists had been around for generations. They were just the kind of things like Mr. Blackwell puts out his top 10 worst dressed and top 10 best dressed. Cosmopolitan often has the 10 most eligible bachelors, and you'll see in other magazines 10 best summertime desserts and that kind of thing. So I thought, well, these people are just barely qualified to put out these lists. Certainly our credentials are just as tenuous as that, so I figured we could do our own top 10 lists, and so we did. I thought it would last a couple of weeks, and then we'd retire it the way we retire most of our running gags after, everyone's sick of them after a month or so. But for some reason, they persevered. We stuck to them. And they've operated maybe, in a way, in lieu of a monologue for Dave. He doesn't really do jokes, a sort of stand-up comedy routine when he comes out at the beginning of a show the way Johnny Carson does on The Tonight Show. So he generally makes a few muttering comments and sits down. I guess the top 10 list has kind of supplanted that as a little grace before supper to get the show rolling.
What was the first top 10 list you wrote?
Well, the very first list we did was top 10 words that almost rhyme with peas. Kind of an odd, quaint, and archaic sounding topic now, but it was just supposed to be an exercise in pointlessness like most of the show was. I mean, I have the list right in front of me. Those 10 words were heats, rice, moss, ties, needs, lens, ice, nurse, leaks, and the number one word that almost rhymes with peas was meats. So you see, there's technically not any jokes in there at all. It was kind of devoid of jokes. But it was stupid, that's for sure. But we went on, and they got more elaborate as we went on, and we also started tying them in with the day's events and with topical current activities, and that seemed to be the way they function best. And now 9 out of 10 of them do have to do with something in the news that day.
It almost seems surprising that something quite as pointless as that first one would have gone on to last so long.
Oh, I don't know. Think of all the pointless activities that have gone on and on and on and on.
So how soon to deadline are these 10 best lists written?
Boy, they couldn't be sooner to deadline. We actually get them together in about an hour before the show begins. I've literally been typing them into the electronic, you know, Chiron machine that makes it print out on the TV screen as Dave enters to do his monologue jokes at the beginning of the program. So they're really up to the last minute. We get together, we pick a topic, usually, you know, from newspaper headlines or something, and then work on it like an hour. I go into Dave's office. We go over that. He sometimes kicks in a couple. And then we put it on the screen with just moments to go.
Is Letterman ever especially surprised by the 10 best lists? I mean, are they ever written so late that he doesn't get a chance to carefully read them before he does them on the air?
No, I think he's seen every. We're sometimes harried. I mean, again, I'm sometimes changing around items with him backstage while he's being introduced. That kind of scene, but. Surprised? No, I don't think so. He sometimes laughs very hard at some of the items just because he's hearing them. And many of them that we laugh the hardest at, we know we'll never really put on the air. So you know we'll let those slide. We had done just quickly after there had been an airline accident, and we had come up with top 10 pilot excuses for this disaster. And then just about 5 minutes before taping began, we both had second thoughts about it, and I said, we better not do this one. So I wrote a list in under 60 seconds, but it was very simple. It was top 10 numbers between 1 and 10.
You're the head writer for The David Letterman Show. What is the job of the head writer?
Boy, a very good question. I ran into a high school friend of mine recently who had heard I was a head waiter.
Really?
Well, I guess just the similarity, and no. Plus, Dave does sometimes fold $20 bills into my palm, so it's similar to that in that respect. I guess I'm like a squad leader. There's right now we've got like 8 writers, and we all work together all day long. Dave, coming in and out of my office and their offices, but basically I sort of lead and organize and motivate, and then kind of run the stuff past Dave Letterman, and then talk to whatever, production people we need to talk to, the people who get the props or get the costumes or, if I need to get a big jar of red ants, I let them know and they go get us a big jar of red ants. It's that kind of thing. I guess just like a coach or, I guess like a non-commissioned officer, a sergeant. Well, you get the idea.
Do you have to show all the scripts to Standards and Practices before they're broadcast?
Theoretically, but, we don't really have scripts. That's what's sort of hard. It's not like, there's something that says Dave says this, Paul says that, then this happens. And some things we have scripts for, we answer our viewer mail on Fridays, and sometimes we build elaborate, silly props. And those are often in script form just because you need more than a few minutes to, get something like that together for airtime. They haven't had really too much trouble with us, though. I mean, we're not, except for, again, the occasional brand name headache. And, and besides our sophomoric experimentation with Dave saying, bite me on the air and that kind of thing, we're not really out to, stretch the envelope of profanity or suggestive situations. I think other programs have carried that banner nobly, and we really are interested in other stuff.
GE is now the parent company of NBC, and there are often cracks about GE that are made on The Letterman Show. Are there any guidelines that you're supposed to follow about what ways you're allowed to to discuss or mock GE?
It may just be that we're on a remote floor in the building and are on at a late hour, but no, we've never heard anything along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
I know it would be, satisfy an anti-corporate impulse to think, yes, they tell us exactly what, but they really don't. And while maybe it seems the ribbing Dave gives to General Electric is not very serious, nevertheless, I think sometimes he's fairly sincere about their bottom line mentality and the fact that, well, they do, at least in dealing with what was a fairly healthy creative, energetic broadcasting operation. I think they did take a somewhat pinheaded approach in demoralizing what was a winning team to begin with. But they've never, for what it's worth, they've never given us any problem really whatsoever.
How about the other NBC people who you sometimes take shots at? I mean, even in the top 10 list, you have Tom Brokaw's top 10 turn-ons.
Well, but he's a good sport, and he's frequently on the program, and he's even gone so far to jeopardize his credibility by, you know, just doing some fairly silly things for us. I mean, you know, we've had, he's videotaped little pieces so that when Dave throws a pencil through the window behind him, we'll see Tom Brokaw pick it up and put it in his pocket, that kind of thing. He seems to be a good sport about it. There have been, I mean, I know that there are other people in NBC who maybe aren't crazy about us. There was the, I think, over-publicized so-called feud between Dave and Bryant Gumbel, springing from the incident in which Dave, at the invitation of the Today Show producer, interrupted the Today Show's primetime special by yelling out a window with a bullhorn while an interview was taking place with the cast of Miami Vice. And I think Bryant Gumbel was a little annoyed at that. And so for a year or two, there were some hard feelings. But he and Dave made up on the air in what I thought should have been a moment in broadcasting history, but I'm not sure if it was, maybe we were the only ones who cared. But anyway, that seems to have been largely patched up.
Why don't we close with another top 10 list? Maybe you can read for us the one about why TV is better than books.
Sure, be happy to. Nothing would give me greater pleasure. For all those Fresh Air Top 10 fans, this is Top 10 Reasons Why TV is Better Than Books. Number 10, book readers miss out on KTEL record offers. Number 9, can't drive and read at the same time. Number 8, no one ever got a paper cut from Hugh Downs. Number 7, books ask difficult questions, but don't give away cars or Caribbean cruises for right answers. Number 6, books written by pasty-skinned geeks, TV full of chesty babes. Number 5, Soul Train. Number 4, learning to work TV set, solid training for future astronauts. Number 3, TV, easier to spell than book. Number 2, no fun to dance in your underwear in front of book about Jane Pauley. And the number 1 reason why TV is better than books, Ralph Waldo Emerson, The Equalizer. Enough said.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Steve O'Donnell collaborated on the Late Night with David Letterman book of Top 10 Lists. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. More today on the politics of the federal budget. The government is back at work today. President Bush signed a continuing resolution keeping the federal government working for a few more days. And we'll hear about the news that the White House is inclined, it seems, to approve a budget that Democrats on Capitol Hill are now rewriting. Also, more from Israel and yesterday's events on Temple Mount. Tensions continue to run high there after yesterday's killings of Palestinians by Israeli police. And also a special report on the California condor and whether that bird rescued from extinction might now be able to return to the wild.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. John Updike has written 4 novels about his character, Harry Rabbit Engstrom, one for each decade since the 50s. There was Rabbit Run, Rabbit Redux, Rabbit is Rich, and now there's the final Rabbit novel. Book critic John Leonard has a review of Rabbit at Rest.
In one of John Updike's non-Rabbit novels, The Coup, an African has this insight. I perceived that a man, in America, is a failed boy. All 4 Rabbit novels are a gloss on this brief text. In Rabbit at Rest, the last of them, Harry Rabbit Engstrom may dress up as Uncle Sam in the 4th of July parade, but like America, he's run out of gas. Just listen to him, at age 55, dividing his time in semi-retirement between the car lot in Brewer, Pennsylvania, and a Florida condo called Valhalla Village. Though his inner sense of himself, he thinks, is of an innocuous passive spirit, a steady small voice that doesn't want to do any harm, get trapped anywhere, or ever die, there is this other self seen from outside, a 6'3" ex-athlete weighing at least 230, a fearsome bulk with eyes that see and hands that grab and teeth that bite, A body eating enough at one meal to feed 3 Ethiopians for a day. A shameless consumer of gasoline, electricity, newspapers, hydrocarbons, carbohydrates. From too much consumption of junk food, cheap sensations, and disposable ideas, Rabbit will explode. This failed boy, who likes Reagan and voted for Bush and misses the Cold War because it gave you a reason to get up in the morning, dreams of an enormous scoop-shaped space, an amphitheater, an audience somehow for whom he is performing, though there is no other person in the dream. Just this sense of presence, of echoing, august, dreadfully solemn presence. He wakes frightened, with a dribble down from one corner of his mouth. He feels like a drum that has been struck. The space he was dreaming of, he now recognizes as his ribcage. Inside the ribcage is Rabbit's heart, like the bomb on Pan Am 103 that he can't stop reading and dreaming about. As much as Rabbit fears women, he's more afraid of death. As much as he identifies with the Dalai Lama and obsesses about Jews, he's lost his way with God. I wish I cared more. The last installment, Rabbit is Rich, like the first installment, Rabbit Run, was just about perfect. As Skylab fell, Rabbit jogged, a king of the ghosts, and beneath his sneakers the dead stared up, family and friends and the famous, whole races like the Cambodians. And I jogged right alongside him, prepared to believe that maybe God is in the universe the way salt is in the sea, giving it a taste. But Rabbit at rest, like Rabbit Redux, seems strained, as if desperate to include everything the decade had to offer, whether it fit in a novel or not, to suck up the 1980s like a berserk vacuum cleaner. You want liberated women? Rabbit's wife Janice goes to work in real estate. You want cocaine and a savings and loan scandal? Rabbit's son Nelson is a crackhead and an embezzler and goes into a 12-step program and talks in bumper stickers. You want AIDS? Somebody's got it. You want terrorism? There's Pan Am 103, ripping open like a rotten melon. Maybe Updike is worn out from America, a nation of failed boys. Maybe he's just weary of Rabbit. But Rabbit, tired meat, moist cheese, has played his last basketball game. Too late, he found out that there's more to being a human being than having your own way. High school's over.
John Leonard is a columnist for New York Newsday and media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Rabbit at Rest by John Updike. Our interviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Joan Tuohy, with research assistance from Lisa McCullough and Dan Buskirk. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Dennis Hopper on Blue Velvet Easy Rider James Dean Paranoia and his new film, The Hotspot. Also, A Man and His Dogs. Artist William Wegman tells us about photographing his pet dogs, Man Ray and Fay Ray. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.